Okay, well, say a brief share on Purim and the halachas of Purim particularly. One of the things I was thinking about is life presents its various stresses, and we have a tendency sometimes to blow things out of proportion. One of the things we can think about Purim time is that that really is the trait of Haman. Haman blows everything out of proportion. Haman, the Medrash tells us, is Mamuchan, the advisor who tells Achashverosh to take a harsh stance against Vashti for not appearing at the party. What does Mamuchan say? It's not only the king that she's rebelling against. This is going to cause a mutiny. This is going to cause a civil war. All of the women are going to rebel against their husbands and against all of these sarim. I mean, because Vashti wouldn't come and be looked at Achashverosh's party, all of your 127 provinces are going to go, they're going to be destroyed. It's preposterous. But that's the trait of Haman. He generalizes from something small and he blows it up into something enormous, which he does in his own personal frustrations as well. He feels on top of the world. He's receiving all kinds of honors and promotion. And then he passes Mordechai, who won't bow down to him. And he tells his wife, I can't stand it. And it's interesting, in the Megillah, it sounds like what really bothered him was that he couldn't enjoy the party. Because when his wife advises him, make a gallows 50 amos tall, and tell Achashverosh to hang Mordechai, the upshot of that is, and then you can go to the party happy. It bothered him. It was disturbing his party. But it's v'cholze inen v'shoveli, it's all not for naught. I don't have what I want. And the Megillah tells us he became angry when he saw Mordechai wouldn't bow to him, and he decided, I won't only take out my revenge against Mordechai, I'll take it against Am Mordechai, the nation of Mordechai. And then the next verse says, and I'll take it out, all the Jews, he wanted to pass a decree to destroy Hashmid, Larug, Abed, to wipe out, annihilate all of the Jewish people. The Talmud tells us it was really a three-step process. First he was angry at Mordechai. Then he said, I'll be angry at Mordechai's category, his ilk. So he was angry at all of the Chachamim, all of the Rabbonim. Then he said, why only the rabbis? I'll wipe out the whole nation. His anger, it expands. He makes a mountain out of a molehill. So one of the Megillah makes a point of letting us see that. It's tangential to the story, really. Or maybe it isn't, but it's not immediately apparent why it's intrinsic to the story. But the Megillah lets us see glimpses of Haman's personality, I think, specifically, so we say, I don't want to be like that. So sometimes when we feel that we're taking something perhaps out of proportion, we should remember that's the trait of Haman, and not at all of of Mordechai. Discuss some of the halachas coming up. Of course, Monday will be Tanis Esther. Where is Tanis Esther found, the fast of Esther? Where is it found in the Gemara that has to be observed? Nowhere. It's the one fast that we have that does not appear in the Gemara. It might be alluded to in the Gemara, according to some commentators' understanding, but certainly the Gemara never says explicitly. The other fast days that we observe, Yom Kippur, is from the Torah. The other four are from the prophets and clearly referred to in the Gemara explicitly. Tanis Esther does not appear in the Gemara. It has a source in what's called Maseches Sofrim, which is a work from Chazal, but because it isn't of Gemara Talmudic origin, the halacha takes it a little bit more light, not entirely more lightly, but the bottom line, somebody who's feeling even a little bit ill, if we would say maybe to push it for another Tanis, for Tanis Esther, we're quicker to allow one to get. In general, if somebody's ill, almost all the Tanias, Allah would be the person should eat, but especially Tanis Esther, because it is of lesser severity. In addition, any other Tanis that falls out on Shabbos, if Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos or Shabbos or B'Tamuz, Allah, as we know, we observe it on Sunday. We delay it. And the Gemara has a principle, Akadume Inish Peranu Salam Akadmin, and a bad thing, we don't want to make it early. If there's something bad that's inevitable, so delay it, push it off, tomorrow, the next day. We always want to delay a bad thing. So since the other Taniyos, fast days that we observe, are bad days, tragedies happen. Five tragedies happened on Tisha B'Av, and later in history there are others as well, and similar Shavuot and B'Tamuz, and the other fast days we have. Tanis Esther was not a day of tragedy. There was no tragedy. In fact, it's the day they won the war. maybe fought the war and won. The post can therefore tell us that Tanis Esther differs in its nature from other Tanias. It is to remind us of the power of tefillah, of prayer, and tshuva. Just as in the time of Mordechai and Esther, when there was a threat, they responded with Tanis and tefillah, and it worked, we reenact that. But there is no tragedy that we are commemorating and recalling, and therefore, if Tanis Esther falls in on Shabbos, it actually is pushed up to Thursday. They don't want to fast on Friday to go right from a fast into Shabbos. They make it early. In contradistinction to every other Tanis where we make it later, Tanis Esther can be made early. One reason is because if you pushed off Tanis Esther, it would go to Purim, and you can't make Purim later because Purim can't be made later. That's another reason. But in the early poskim, it says the reason is because Tanis Esther lav puranusa. It's not puranus. Puranus means a bad day. Tanis Esther is not a bad day. So it differs a little bit in its nature. There's also a notion, the whole recurring theme of Purim is opposites. Pur, the name Purim means lots, and in the Krovitz of Purim, which is a liturgical poem, some people recite on Purim, it says, Pur Haman Nepachu Purenu, his lot turned to our lot. Everything turns around. The gallows he wanted to hang Mordechai on, he got hung on. Everything he wanted to be led around on the horse, he had to leave it. Mordechai around, everything turns around. It's a turnabout. Everything in the Purim story is a flip, an about face. So some farshim, some commentators talk about a notion that Tanis Esther also is supposed to lead into Purim. So it's also like an about face. You go from fasting to feasting. It's an opposite, a contrast. Also to capture the nature of v'nahapachu, of turning things around. That is how we observe Purim. Okay, some of the halachas of Purim day itself. So we have the four mems. The four mitzvahs of Purim are four mems. Reading the Megillah, Mishteh, the party. Manos and Matanos, giving portions to other people, giving the Shalach Manos, and giving the Matanos Levion. So Mikra Megillah, of course, is the first one we encounter. The Mishnah says we read the Megillah both at night and in the daytime. We hear it twice. It's a little bit of a difficult mitzvah, especially because we have this custom of banging for Haman, which has a tendency to escape beyond the confines of just Haman, and therefore often there's noise. It's interesting. If you look in the early poskim from a century or two ago, it seems like it was a rampant problem that there really was no decorum. Mishnah Berurah, an earlier poskim, it's like better, they should just forego that minhag already because it's not a real minhag, you have to bang. As a matter of fact, there's a Sephardic custom to just bang at the last Haman. And Rav Henkin, who was one of the great poskim from the 20th century, he writes in his Luach, which a lot of the rabbis use as a guidebook to the Minhagim in a shul, he writes people should adopt that custom because they bang for Haman and you can't hear anything. And many of the earlier poskim decry this as well. Thank God, I think in our time we bang for Haman, but we managed to get the decorum back so people can hear the Megillah, as far as I've seen. But we should be careful with that because really the mitzvah is to hear every word of the Megillah. That requires some attention and care and concern. So the halacha is like this. It is appropriate and advisable for every person listening to the Megillah to have a text in front of himself or herself. And the reason, it doesn't have to be a scroll, it doesn't have to be a cloth, a real Megillah, but a printed text in the back of a chumash or an otherwise printed Megillah, the reason being as follows. I have to hear every word of the Megillah. Ideally, I should hear every word read from somebody who's reading out of a cloth, out of a kosher, a valid Megillah. However, if I miss a word here and there, I can recite it with the halacha calls by heart. By heart means where you're not reading it out of a real Megillah scroll. If I'm reading out of a chumash, that's equivalent in halacha to reading it by heart. The halacha is you can read up to half of the Megillah by heart. Three major caveats. When we say up to half, it can't be the beginning. If I missed the whole first pasuk, I'm making so much noise. The Balkore, the Chazan read the first pasuk, nobody could hear it. By the time I heard him, he was already, let's say, two psukim into the Megillah. So I read that all to myself out of my printed edition. That's no good. If it's a pasuk, I think, or more, that's a problem. And the same is true of the end. If you didn't hear the end, like a whole pasuk at the end, that's no good. And finally, and perhaps this is the biggest stringency, it can't be a whole section. I missed a whole section. There was so much noise, there was such a distraction, so that I missed a whole, what the halakha calls an inyan, a topic, then I can't recite that all, quote-unquote, by heart. You can ask, what's an inyan? No? Yeah?
Well, you're trying to catch up with halakha is simple.
Right, so you got to...
Like,
you gotta hope for a Haman. Hope for a Haman. Yeah, you have to try to catch up. That's true. It can get challenging, especially if he's moving quickly.
Practically, does this work?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I do all the time. It could be in a career where they're not stopping for Haman and then moving quickly because people are around. It can be harder. It's true. But hopefully, in those careers, you have better decorum. But not necessarily for babies and whatnot, not necessarily. Hopefully it shouldn't be an issue.
I mean, it doesn't count if your brain, you know you're hearing it, but you're...
Probably be out of order, though.
If you're reading and you're hearing the person at the same time, and so you're not really missing words, but in between...
There can be a mild distraction.
You're not conscious that you're hearing it.
If my mind is entirely elsewhere, that's not good, but if to a degree, we can do two things at once.
You're telling a kid to be quiet. You know you're hearing the vocal.
Yeah, but you hear it, okay. Yeah. If very distracting happens, that would be different. Okay. Then I think we can do two things at once. But again, the biggest limitation being that if I miss a whole inyan, and many later posts can say, we don't know what constitutes an inyan. What is an inyan? A whole chapter? A part of, you know, if, let's say the part of the Megillah where Mordechai overhears Big Son and Sarah plotting against the king, and he gets them in trouble. I assume that would be considered a whole topic, or the whole scene, so to speak. So it's hard to know exactly what is considered a whole topic, but usually that's not what happens. Usually it's a few words, and we try to catch up. That's why if I have a text in front of me, I can read it. If I don't, and I miss a few words, I may end up lost. That's why it's very good to have a text. It also keeps us focused. If I don't have a text, my mind can already be planning how many shalachmanas I'm giving, or how I'm getting to the Suda, or how I'm cleaning for Pesach, or who knows what else comes up in our minds. We have a halacha, at least we have a minyan, so we make a bracha afterward of Haravas Rivenu, that God fights our fights for us. That's of course, the primary notion of Purim is Persumei Nisa, publicizing the miracle. We try to read the Megillah in a big group. So this bracha is sort of to underscore that idea. Three brachas are made before the Megillah, according to our meaning, both in the night and daytime. The bracha of Al Mikra Megillah and the reading of the Megillah, She'asa Nisim, the special bracha we say on Chanukah and Purim, that God has done miracles for us, and Shehecheyanu. Shehecheyanu means that He has sustained us and kept us alive and brought us to this propitious time, which is a bracha we make whenever we come to a joyous occasion, particularly a Yom Tov festival. In the daytime Megillah reading, we're supposed to have in mind the other mitzvahs of the day as well. When they recite the Shehecheyanu in the daytime Megillah reading, I have in mind Shalachmanos and Seuda and Matanos Levionim. However, if for some odd reason one would not be hearing the Megillah in the daytime, stranded on an island, there's no Megillah, or... Right, I was thinking that. Didn't want to get specific. It can happen. Let us know. We can try to send some, depending on time. Okay. Actually, last year was very nice. I sent an email. I got a call right before Purim. I needed somebody to go to the hospital. Somebody volunteered, and we were able to work it out. But if a person would, I'm just to illustrate a point. If one wouldn't be hearing the Megillah, so you might ask, should I say a Shehecheyanu on my other mitzvahs? Allah is no, because they're not really unique enough. We do eat on Shabbos and Yom Tov as well. Purim is a special mitzvah to eat, to have a Suda, but it's not entirely different. We do give gifts to other people, we give money to the poor. Those mitzvahs are not entirely different as Mikra Megillah is. Therefore, we use the Shehecheyanu of the Megillah for those other mitzvahs as well, but they don't warrant their own independent Shehecheyanu. At least the Ashkenazic post can say if a kriya is being held for women only, that's not so uncommon. So one of the opinions in the poskim is that a woman's mitzvah here, the Megillah, is slightly different from a man's. It's a very subtle distinction, and it's not universally agreed to, but that is that a man has an obligation to recite the Megillah. I really have to read the Megillah, to recite it. so maybe I'm not going to, so he'll recite it for me. That's the recurring concept of Shemaya Kaona. One person says Kiddush, it's as if we all said Kiddush. He reads the Megillah, it's as if we all said the Megillah. A woman's obligation might be to hear it, not to recite it, to hear it. So for me, it's to recite it, and he's reciting it for me, it's as if I said it. For a woman, at least according to the Baal Halachas Gedolos, one opinion, it really is to hear the Megillah. Slightly different obligation, might relate to Yuvim of Kriyas HaTorah in general, whatever the explanation is, but therefore, Sfardim, I believe, don't pask in this way, but the Ashkenazic post can say if it's a Kriya for women alone, the bracha would be Lishmoa Mikra Megillah, to hear the reading of the Megillah, not Al Mikra Megillah. Not on the reading, but to hear the reading of it, because the mitzvah is slightly different.
I have a question.
Yes.
A woman can, the obligation is only to hear it, and if it's being read by a woman, does that fulfill it, or does it have to be read by a person to have the obligation to read it?
There's a discussion about this in the postgame. Depends. I don't have a true opinion. There's a discussion about a woman being most the other woman. She, according to some, could be most the other woman. She could do it. Yeah. Question.
What if it's not specifically for women only, but mostly women attend, and if there's like one or two men...
Then they'll say Al Mikra already. Then they'll say the regular bracha, usually, yeah. According to some, anyway, we would say the regular bracha, so then they would say the Al Mikra Megillah, the regular bracha. There is a minhag mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, there are four psukim that we recite out loud. Some even compare this like to Hallel. Hallel is responsive. Whenever we have a song that's supposed to be a celebration, so it's done responsively. So it's almost like these sukkim, since these are either turning points or important points in the Megillah, so it's almost as if the chazan and the congregation are saying something responsively. But they did. They are mishum simcha. It's supposed to be an exercise in experiencing the simcha of the Megillah. In some shuls, there's a minhag, there's one other pasuk not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, that the chazan again stops and everybody reads it, and then he reads it again, and that's the 10 sons of Haman. In many shuls, the chazan stops, and then everybody says, everybody recites the 10 sons of Haman. The Rugged Shavar Gaon, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, who's a great Talmud Chacham, suggested, it's an odd minhag. There's no celebration in the 10 sons of Haman. Why do we do this? So he said as follows. He said that this concept in halacha of Shomea Ka'ona, that one person can say something, and it's as if the other person said it, only works to the degree that you said it, and it's as if I said it, because I listened to you. But how you said it, that you can't transfer from one person to the other. Since the Gemara says the 10 sons of Haman are supposed to be recited in one breath, that's why the Baal Kareh reads the 80 miles an hour, says the fact that he said it, it's as if I said it, but the fact that he said it in one breath, that he can't transfer to me. That I got to do for myself. He says that's why the minhag is to stop and everybody reads it to himself. So I mentioned this in class, and one of the girls asked, so why doesn't he read it and we'll all hold our breath? Which I think is a good question. Obviously, they have to go together. But that's an explanation of a minhag. Otherwise, it is somewhat mysterious why we do that. But not all shuls have that minhag in any event. The main thing is to try to make sure to hear the Megillah in its entirety and to have a text in front of us. And the mitzvahs of the day, they kind of go in pairs. Reading the Megillah goes together with Matanos Levyonim, giving gifts to the poor. The Purim meal goes together with Shalach Manos, sending portions to the people. The proof comes, if you ever visit Yerushalayim on Purim, a walled city from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun observes Purim on the 15th, not on the 14th. The 15th of Adar can occur on Shabbos. So what happens if you're in Yerushalayim? The 15th of Adar that year, which is their Purim, is on Shabbos, so they have what's called a Purim Meshulash, a tripled Purim, because it's spread out over 3 days. This is the halacha, the way it's practiced. On Friday, they read the Megillah and give Matanos Levyonim. On Shabbos, the only observance is that Al Hanisim, the Tefillah of Purim, is recited, And on Sunday, they have the meal and send Shalach Manos. So you can see from the grouping that the gift to the poor goes together with reading the Megillah. The reason for that is because the Gemara says that because the Megillah reading brings about such a big gathering of people, right? The shuls are always packed for Megillah reading, and because the halacha really is that on Purim we're supposed to be particularly benevolent, the Shulchan Aruch says anybody who sticks out his hand asking on Purim, you give. Other times you might check his credentials, see what the cause is. On Purim, call me Shaposha, yeah, anybody puts out his hand, you give. Therefore, the indigent, the poor, expect it's a good time to go collecting. Gemara says they turn to the Megillah reading at the time for a good opportunity to collect money. So they go hand in hand. And the Shalach Manos and the Suda go together, because according to many poskim, the reason why we send Shalach Manos is really to make sure everyone will have a Purim Suda. One of the explanations why we give Shalach Manos is we want to make sure everybody will have a Purim meal. And if you're only going to say, well, raise your hand if you don't have one, that's embarrassing. We have a general concept in halacha, shalol levayish es mi she'ein lo. You don't want to do something where everybody who doesn't have stands out. That's not what we want to do. So therefore, the Nevi'im, the prophets, the Chachamim, made an institution. Everybody should send. Everybody send to everybody, and therefore we know that everybody will have.
It really changed the Shalach Manos if people thought of it that way, because you're not getting too many food groups.
Yes, I was going to mention that. In fact, with halacha, I think it would be a good idea if we send candies and goodies and treats and sweets. It's a good idea if one of the Shalach Manos, and usually it is this way anyway, at least one of them is actually made of foods that you would eat at a meal. A kugel, a piece of meat, a bottle of wine, bread, even something other than fruit gems. I don't think it's such a bad thing that many of the Shalach Manos today are sweets, because I think the number of people that it's become assumed that we send Shalach Manos to is much, much higher than it used to be. If you leave to send one, the halacha is you really have to send just one Shalach Manos, which is composed of two different things, to someone else, and if that was often the case. Nowadays, it's accepted, Baruch Hashem, we're more affluent, you send to a lot of people. If we were sending a hefty Shalach Manos to all the people, it would be a phenomenal expense, and probably a lot of wasted food. Also, so it's not such a bad thing that people don't make such elaborate Shalach Manos, but at least one of them should be something substantial. The Rambam and Shulchan Aruch copies the wording of the Rambam, says Shnei Manos Basar, two portions of meat, O Shnei Mini Tavshilin, or two dishes. Tavshil means like a cooked food, and it seems like he's giving even like a hierarchy, a pecking order. It sounds like it's supposed to be something substantial, so at least one of them should be something a little more substantial than just candy, something that one could eat in a meal. It's interesting. The post can talk about what happens if I send Shalach Manos and the person declines. Here you go. Happy Purim. No, thank you. Thank you very much. Very nice. Keep it. So have I fulfilled the mitzvah or not? See, a lot of these things for us sound theoretical. How many do you have to send to be yotzei? What do you mean? I send 50,000 for the whole signing of the table. Take that with Shalach Manos. Baruch Hashem, we have that degree of wealth, but in times of old, people didn't have that much. And these questions of how much do you have to send to the yotzei, and what do you do if he says no, can I keep it, was a relevant question. So the Chassam Sofer, in a response to him, says it depends. Depends on how we understand the mitzvah of Shalach Manos. One explanation is, as I just said, we want to make sure everyone has a meal. The other explanation would be, Haman said, Yeshno am echad mefuzer meforad bein ha'amim. There's a nation that's scattered among, interspersed among the other nations, and the rabbis of the Gemara and the Medrash understood that he was saying that we're a fractious people, not just that we're scattered, but that we lack unity. One of the things, obviously, we therefore seek to do on Purim is to show unity, right? The emphasis is on mitzvahs bein adam l'chaveiro, friendship and so on. So the other explanation is simply we want to show the gesture of Ahavas Yisrael, Ahavas Reim, love, brotherly love in the right city. So says the Chassam Sofer, if the reason is the former, that we need to make sure everyone has a meal, and we have to have it that everyone sends, because otherwise people will be embarrassed, then I must send. I must see to it that you get the meal. The fact that I made a nice gesture, but then you didn't take it, so the mission was not accomplished. Whereas if it's the latter explanation, it's just to show the gesture, I'm a nice guy. I like you. So you turned it down. Okay, but did I do something nice? Did I express friendship? Yes. So then I would have been yote. The Ramon Shulchan Aruch, in fact, says that if a person is mochel, that one has fulfilled the mitzvah. It depends on the reasoning, but that seems to be the consensus. That usually doesn't happen anyway. Something that comes up sometimes is that people aren't home. They're out delivering to you. You're delivering to them. So if they're going to get it on Purim, you've done the mitzvah. Usually all of this is moot because, as I said before, it says in the Megillah, Mashloch Manos Ish L'Re'ehu, just means man to his friend. All you have to do is send one Shalach Manos. So usually you send many more. At least one of them gets delivered, usually many of them, so it's not a question as to whether we are yotzei the mitzvah. Common misconception that the two manos, the two foods, have to have different brachos. Some people express great shock that this is not the case. I don't know where the myth comes from. There's no halacha that has to be a different brachos. As I said before, the Rambam's paradigm, Shalach Manos, he says, Shnei Manos Basar, two portions of meat. Is it? They write it?
Every single one that
I have
to
give
the food, two different brachos.
Okay. So people are writing, I don't know that's where it's coming from, but in the halachic sources, there's no basis. They have to have different brachos. I know, yeah. I don't think so. If shliach means another person. Let me just step back a second. The Binyan Tzion, that's one of the great poskim, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, was a great German poskim, has a response to him in which he says that it seems from the simple reading of the words that shalach manos, mishloach manos, sending portions means sending. When I give you something, that's not called sending, that's called giving. Sending, by definition, means that it's not in the hand of the sender. It's a third party is bringing it. And he says he's not sure. If you actually read the response, it sounds like he's pretty sure. You don't really have to. He says it would be better. It might be that that's the way you're supposed to do it. Alternatively, by the way, he says it could be the reason why the Megillah used the word sending versus giving is to answer the question I raised before. Have you fulfilled the mitzvah? The person declined. So if it's giving, giving means that you get it into your hand. Sending means it's the gesture, it's the act of sending it over to you, even if you don't, it connotes the step before receiving. He says it could be that's why the Megillah used the term mishloach, sending rather than giving. He says, but it could be that mishloach means that it's supposed to be sent. And therefore, the post can say it's certainly a good idea, especially if you give out a lot of them, to send one at least through a shliach. It could be a child, by the way. It could be. So instead of me giving it directly to the other person, I have someone else give it to him. So we fulfill this possible halach. But I believe that would have to be another person. Your doorstep is not a shliach. It has to be someone else. I don't think that would constitute shliach. Again, it's a chumrah. It's not really essential, but it is a good thing to do. I think so. I don't think this is not like a halacha in the Torah. You know, we have certain concepts of shlichus, of agency. We're actually creating halachic halos. You're affecting some halachic status there. We say that it has to be only a Jew can act as a shlich for another Jew. But here, I don't think, even if there is an insistence that it be sent and not given, it's not that it has to work with all the lumdish constructs of shlichus. It's just through a third party. So I would think that would be okay. Some folks can talk about, are you allowed to rely on the chazaka shliach osa shlichusa? We have a general assumption: if you send somebody to do something, you can assume he'll do it, which many bosses would say is not true. But the question of where, when you have a mitzvah performance, are you allowed to rely on that? So they talk about to what degree. I mean, usually. What do they say? Rain, snow, hail, sleet. You can usually rely on it. I think so. I think that would be good enough. So the Shnei Manos don't have to be two different brachos. Most poskim seem to feel that they should be two different things. Interestingly, the Tzitz Eliezer, one of the great poskim, makes a strong case. He says, no, it doesn't have to be two different things. It just has to be, doesn't have to be turkey and corned beef. It can be two portions of the same food, which is a chiddush. Most don't hold that way. Most say it should be two things, which is why we usually give two different items, but they can be of the same bracha. And a drink, the post can say, is good also. It doesn't have to be two foods. It can be a food and a drink as well. Matanos Levyonim. So here, the words of the Megillah are exactly those. Matanos Levyonim. Gifts to four people, plural. So here, I have to give to two different people. Mishloach Manos, friend, sending food items to my friend. I just have to give two things to one friend. But giving gifts to the poor is plural poor. It has to be to two poor people. Some posts can say that there's no minimum shear. Give a nickel. However, others say that it's supposed to be an amount with which one could buy a meal, a minimal meal, or enough bread that would be considered a meal, which really is not very much at all, even if we'll say it should be a half-decent meal. If you're talking about a few dollars, the bare minimum to fulfill the mitzvah of Matanos Levyonim is not a major expense, Baruch Hashem, in our, for people in our time. However, we should remember the words of the Rambam and all of the later poskim quoted, Mutav laharbus matanos levyonim laharbus besidoso ubishiluach manos lareyav. It is better to increase, to do a lot of matanos levyonim, gifts to the poor, than feeding himself at the seuda or feeding his friends and sending shalach manos. So the Rambam is saying that if I have a choice of what to emphasize, what to spend the most on, it really is ideal that it be Matanos Levyonim, and the Rambam explains, Shein Simcha Gedola Umfuara El Sameach Levaniyim. There is no greater joy, and no, I guess I could translate this way, honorable, more honorable joy than making poor people happy. The Rambam reiterates this in Hilchos Yom Tov. He says, true Simcha is knowing that those who don't have Simcha are happy. If I'm happy, but I feel and I'm aware of people around me who aren't, who are needy, then that Simcha is very lacking. So it often ends up not being this way. To give a social circle, you have to give to 1,050 people. Shalach Manos, about 10 minutes with the Shalach Manos, there's no money for Matanos Levyonim. That's not really the way it should be. And it's nice, actually, the institutions now, they make lists, and they're cutting them down a little bit. But we should try to remember that Matanos Levyonim is a primary mitzvah. Showing Avas Reyim is important, but it doesn't mean I have to, you know, I have so much candy that nobody knows what to do with the candy afterward. With the Shalach Manos, so we should try to emphasize the Matanos Levyonim, certainly. The halacha of Matanos Levyonim is ideally that the gift should be given to the poor person on Purim. That doesn't mean it has to leave my hand on Purim, which is why usually the way we work it is Bonim Shul, who collect money, it can be given in advance of Purim, and it will be distributed by different organizations and individuals to poor people on Purim Day itself, on the day of Purim. And in so doing, one fulfills the mitzvah. That's the way it's normally done. An interesting shaila in halacha is, what happens if I send Matanos Levyonim money to an organization in Yerushalayim that's going to distribute money on Purim? But Purim in Yerushalayim is the 15th of Adar. My Purim is the 14th of Adar. So on the day that I'm observing Purim, is my money going to any poor person? No. So do you look at my Purim or my money's Purim? Where my money is, so to speak, it's being given on Purim. But where I am, it's not. This is a question in the postkin. I don't know the answer. But usually we give some, even give tzedakah to Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, usually we give something local too. And the question would be more academic. But we should make sure that money is given on Purim Day. I said before there's a halacha mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, or a concept that on Purim we're very loose in giving money. But remember, Matanos Levyonim means to poor people. Giving money to a yeshiva, a shul, a mikveh, that's a big mitzvah, but that's not Matanos Levyonim. Matanos Levyonim means to poor people. Interestingly, in some places in halacha, Evyon means somebody who's extremely destitute. Ani is here, Evyon is here, but here the post can say it doesn't mean it to be terribly impoverished. A person who is poor is good enough. We don't work with the technical definition of Evyon as it exists in other places in the Gemara. Here it means anyone who is poor, that's certainly somebody to whom we should give Matanos Levyonim. The Seuda of Purim, the Purim feast. The Gemara says, Michayev Inish Lo Besumi Bepuria. Person is obligated to become spirited, inebriated on Purim, Ad Dela Yada Ben Arar Haman LeBaruch Mordechai, until he's so confused he doesn't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. The very next line of Gemara tells a story. It's one of the most comical stories, at least not when it happened, but for us to read. One of the most comical stories, perhaps what you see in the Gemara, it says, immediately the next line of the Gemara, it says that Rabbah invited Rabbi Zeira. Rabbah was one of the rabbis from the Gemara. He invited Rabbah and Rabbi Zeira had their Purim Seuda together. And Rabbah became drunk. Come Rabbah, shachtei l'Rabbi Zeira. Rabbah got up and he slaughtered Rabbi Zeira. Some commentators say it doesn't mean literally, it means he strangled him, he did something, endangered his life. Some say, no, it's literal, he killed him. And then it says he nurtured him back to life, which again, either means miraculously or means almost miraculously, depending on which parish you follow. He brought him back to life. And then the end of the Gemara says, the next year, Rabbah said, Rabbi Zeira, would you like to dine with us on Purim? And Rabbi Zeira said, no, thank you. He said, Lo b'chol shasa yisrach hashnis, not every year does a miracle happen. Fortunate enough, last year, we're going to my uncle's. Rabbi Zeira turned down the invitation from Rabbah. The simple understanding of the Gemara, the way most Rishonim take it, is the Gemara is trying to say, true, theoretically, Mechayev Inish L'Vesuri Puri, you have to get so drunk on Purim, but look, even among the great Chachmei HaGemara, becoming drunk was not did not have a good effect. The simple understanding of the Gemara is therefore saying to tone it down, not to go to an extreme. The Rambam therefore writes a person should drink a little more than he does normally, and once he drinks, he'll fall asleep, and if he falls asleep, presumably he doesn't know the difference between Araman and Baruch Mordechai. Anyway, that's the way most Rishonim interpret it, and all the later Poskim warn of the ills of drinking too much alcohol. Certainly, if a person's not going to act appropriately or act foolish, then it's not a true simcha v'yamtiv. That's not not appropriate. And certainly, children should not be allowed to drink. And it has a lot more dangers than good. It has to be taken with serious consideration. But there is a notion of becoming somewhat shikur on Purim in a spirit of simcha shel yamtiv. It's interesting, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach got married on Purim in Yerushalayim, so it was the 15th. He got married on Purim, and there's a tradition that the chassan at the groom's table, at the chassan's dish, says a dvar Torah, says an insight. So what he said on that occasion was he raised a question that the post can talk about. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you're allowed to get married on Purim. Not all that common, but one can get married on Purim. This seems to run counter to a normal principle we have of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. You don't mix two disparate celebrations. You're not allowed to get married on Pesach or Sukkot or Shavuos because it's a Yom Tov. And you're supposed to experience the joy of the Yom Tov. And if you're experiencing the joy of getting married, it's a distraction. And both celebrations are mitigated due to the other. Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. You're supposed to enjoy the chag, not marriage. You can't, they don't go together. So why is it that Purim is different? So this is a question raised by the Poskim. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach suggested, he said, because the nature of the celebration on Purim is different. Normally, any other festival, the way you experience it is by focusing on the Yom Tov, on the festival. Pesach, you think about Yetzias Mitzrayim, you focus on it, and thereby come to a degree of joy, and the same with Sukkot, and the same with Shavuos. But on Purim, the nature of the celebration is Ad Lo Yada. Here, the prescription the rabbis gave us was celebrate in such a way that you are so confused you don't even understand the Yom Tov anymore. Bring the Simcha to a level. Ar Haman versus Baruch Mordechai is the theme of Purim. And the prescription is celebrate, the mitzvah is celebrate until you reach such a level that you already don't understand the ABCs of the Yom Tov. So he says the nature of the celebration of Purim is through distraction. Every other Yom Tov, the celebration is focused. Here the celebration is distraction. He says, so what's the difference if the distraction is because I'm inebriated or the distraction is because I got married? He said it does, that was the lumdus, that was the idea that he said at that time. But it's reflective of the nature of Simchas Purim. Yeah.
The drinking thing. So theoretically, could one take a nap and forget the liquor before that?
You mean without any drinking?
Yeah.
If a person really did not.
I thought women don't drink.
Women don't generally don't, and I'm saying even among men, if a person really does not enjoy it, it's not like Pesach where there's something you have to ingest. It's not that kind of a mitzvah. There are poskim, by the way, say levesume. The Gemara's wording is chayav inish levesume. It doesn't say lishtos. Levesume is a word with a much more general connotation. It could even be that Chazal used that general word because it has a connotation of drinking, but it really means, like I said before, to be in good spirits. Some say that could really be achieved in other ways. Normally, a person who can enjoy a glass of wine, for instance, to drink a little something. By the way, it says in Shulchan Aruch, Echad Amar Be'Echad Hamamit. Some do more, some do less. A friend of mine, I think, asked my Rosh Hashiva once, what do they do in Europe? Right? We always want to know, this is how we do it today, but are we really doing it the way the custom was? He said, Rebbe, today some people drink more and some people do less. So how do they do in Europe? He said, you know what they do in Europe? Some drink more and some drink less. Always works that way. But a person is not of that inclination, rather keep it more to the left side. But certainly there's nothing wrong with it. I don't know, to just go to sleep, I don't know. But again, if a person doesn't enjoy it, then they wouldn't have to drink anyway, I don't believe. It's interesting, the Shulchan Aruch tells us there's an exemption if somebody damages them Purim out of the celebration. A little while and he causes some damage, he's actually potter, he's exempt, or normally one would have to pay. It's understood this is Mishem Simcha, it's something that the Shulchan Aruch mentions, people who steal things, they grab things one from the other. Like we have in Pesach, grabbing Nafikomen, and the Gemara talks about actually grabbing away Lulav and Esrog from children at the end of Sukkot. There's some things that used to snatch things because out of Simchot, like a charade, a playful kind of a thing, which, by the way, normally in Halacha we're not supposed to do that. It says in the Torah, Lo Signov, and then it says, Lo Signovu. It repeats, you shall not steal again. And the Gemara says, Lo Signov Amanas Lamekat, you shall not steal to pester someone, to play a prank, which the Ketzos HaChoshim, one of the primary commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, says, actually, Isser Daraisa, this is the Torah prohibition. If I steal something from someone else as a prank, he says that's a Torah violation. Rav Pam, the late Rosh Hashiva of Taradat, he has a sefer, a collection of sermons of Musar Shmuzin that he gave. I remember reading there that he said sometimes people play a game with kids, and the kid is playing with something, and the kid looks with it and snatch it away, and where's Rubber Ducky? He says you shouldn't do that because it runs counter to this idea that we don't steal to pester someone. And Moses says sometimes you steal something from someone who's negligent. You want to teach him to be more careful with his things. He walks around with his wallet sticking halfway out of his pocket. You want to teach him a lesson, so you snatch and he gets all nervous. Where's my wallet? You say, I have it. Be more careful because the next guy will steal and won't give it back. The Gemara says, I'm not really supposed to do that. So it actually is a chiddush. It's a novel idea that here it is permissible to snatch things as a means of simcha. It's interesting how firm the rules are really stretched. There's a custom that goes back at least a couple of centuries in the yeshiva world that they would do a Purim spiel, a Purim play, and actually make fun of everybody in the yeshiva. And there are poskim that say they don't like it because where do we have the license to do such a thing? But I remember specifically a friend of mine asked an Irish yeshiva, what was done. They did it in the Lushan. This was the minhag. You shouldn't overdo it in the vituperativeness and the whatever jokes are made there. But it was understood it's part of the simcha, and we can be a little bit perhaps more irreverent than normally without, of course, going overboard. That's the concept of Simchas Purim. The Seuda really should be eaten on Purim. However, there is a minhag to start pretty late in the day and to stretch it into the night. Very often, many people will start the Seuda an hour before Shkia, an hour before sunset, and continue the meal into the night. One wants to eat it earlier, sometimes scheduling. The halacha says one could eat the Purim Suda in the morning as well, but there is a custom to eat it late in the day. One of the poskim, Pesach Frank, says, based on a Tosfos in Maseches Brachos, the Torah tells us that Bilam was going to curse the Jewish people. And the Chachamim Chazal tell us that Bilam knew there's a moment every day when, we don't know exactly what this means, but when God is angry. Pasuk says, Kel Zoim B'chol Yom. God is angry every day for, and the Gemara calculates like a millisecond when there's divine wrath in the world. Bilam had some prophetic powers and knew how to figure out when that moment is, and he was going to capitalize on it and curse the Jewish people in that moment. That's what the Gemara says. And the miracle was that in those days when he was going to do it, God didn't get angry for even that millisecond. That's what the Gemara says. The Balei HaTosfos, the Tosfos says, what was he going to say in that millisecond anyway? What was going to be the curse? So one answer is, Kalaim, destroy them. I can say it pretty quickly. Three-letter word, Kalaim. But the other answer that is given in the Tosfos is he was going to start his curse in that time and continue it afterward. And once you start within the Zaman, within the prescribed time, you can continue it afterward, and it's as if you clinched the right time. So some of the poskim say that if we have this notion with regard to a negative thing, when you start within the Zaman and you continue it after the Zaman, it works for a bad thing, for a curse, for the ability to curse the Jewish people. We have a general rule, Midah Tova Merubah Midah Peronis. God's good traits are much more abundant. Goodness, kindness are much more abundant than harsh judgment. So if it works to curse us, that you can start within the time and continue afterward, you can only imagine when it comes to a mitzvah or something positive, or a tefillah, you can start within the time and continue afterwards. So they say if we start the Purim Suda within Purim, we can stretch it beyond Purim, and as you can naturally intuit, the other explanation is because really the 15th is also Purim. It's not Purim for us, we're not in a walled city, but we don't recite Tachlin. It is a semi-festive day, so continuing Purim into the next day is not so inappropriate. I remember I was once at my Rosh Hashiva's table on Purim. After the Suda, the guys would come and converge on his house, which I'm not sure he appreciated too much. But so there were all these drunken guys on the table, and a fellow came in and was sitting down next to him and talking. He wouldn't be quiet. He's telling, I want to tell the Rosh Hashiva this and told him that, and on and on. Then a fellow walked in with a Shalach Manas. It was about 10 p.m. already, after Purim was over. So he walked in with a Shalach Manos, and he gave it to the Rosh Hashiva. So this guy who's sitting next to him was already very drunk and very talkative. He says, you can't give Shalach Manos now, Purim is over. Right, Rebbe? He turns to the Rosh Hashiva. He says, right? So the Rosh Hashiva says, you already paskened. I can't argue with you. I don't know what he would have said. Because to a degree, if the meal is continuing, perhaps maybe one could suggest that you could give. The simple halacha would be that you couldn't at that time. But remember that story. But again, the Mishta of Purim counteracts the Mishta of Achashverosh. The Jews at that time were considered guilty for the fact that they felt too comfortable at the Suda of Achashverosh. So when we experience Mishta, a feast, in the right way with Simcha Shel Mitzvah, then we are counteracting the mistake, so to speak, that we made at that time. And I'll just conclude with I heard from my Rosh Hashiva not that long ago. It's interesting, we say that the mitzvah of Purim is to become drunk ad de la yada vein arur haman l'baruch Mordechai. This is a side note, I didn't mention before what that means between arur haman and baruch Mordechai. There are many, many explanations. One, by the way, is that the numerical value of arur haman equals baruch Mordechai. Another explanation that Balei HaTosfos tell us is that they used to have a song. There are many Purim songs, so there was a song that had as a refrain, Arhaman, Baruch Mordechai, Baruch Mordechai, Arhaman. It was complicated. When you were a little bit tipsy, you get confused and mix the words. So Adela Yada Ben Arhaman, Baruch Mordechai just means that he no longer can sing the song, or that he no longer can make the mathematical calculation. It's interesting, there's so many different explanations of that phrase that you could range it from an ounce of a wine to a bottle of Johnny Walker, how much confusion it requires to fulfill this specific interpretation of Adol Yada. But in any event, it's interesting that the rabbis articulated Avodah of Purim is not knowing the difference between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai. People think that means on Purim you're not supposed to know the difference between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai. And in fact, to the contrary, it's exactly because the difference between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai is so important to us. The Jews at the time of Achashverosh saw such a sudden change of events. Here they were at the feast of Achashverosh. They weren't forced to be there. We're not forcing anyone. There's kosher food. You're very comfortable. No one could have felt more comfortable and accepted in society than the Jews at that feast. They were partying side by side with Ahasuerus and the Persians. And then, in the blink of an eye, a decree has been passed to wipe out men, women, and children. And it doesn't. Nothing even changed. Ramelech Aman Yashvu Lishtos. It wasn't even an uproar. They sat down to drink. Made a l'chaim last week, or a little while before, over the party where they're sitting side by side, and then Haman and Achashverosh got together and we're going to wipe out the Jews, and nothing had even changed. With the blink of an eye, their whole circumstance was in total opposite of what it was before. The lesson of Purim, therefore, was that the ongoing survival of Jews in Galus is a lot less of a given than we recognize. The name of Hashem doesn't appear in the Megillah, but by the end of the story, they knew that God's name is written all over the Megillah. In the beginning, they didn't see him. We're here, we're comfortable, we're accepted, we're productive members of society, and we're accepted here. By the end of the Megillah, they realized that doesn't guarantee anything. As we've seen time and again throughout Jewish history, that doesn't guarantee anything at all. And the mindset of societies can change very, very quickly. One world event can really topple things, and it's a frightening thing. And therefore, the continued existence of Jews in Galus is a nes, and it does. The name of Hashem is there, whether we see it written explicitly or not. The Gemara says that for a while, the Nevi'im weren't able to say Shemoneh Esrei the way we say it. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanora. It's God who is great, and strong, and mighty, and awesome. And it says that various Nevi'im, I'm not going through the whole text of the Gemara, but weren't able to say those words. Even though they know it's true, they said, we don't see it. We see Jews being afflicted. Where's the greatness of God? Until finally, in the time of Mordechai and Achashverosh, Mordechai and Esther, they said, the mere fact that we're here, Hein Hein Nora Osef, that is the awe, the awesomeness of the Ribbono Shalom. They weren't able to understand it before. Then when you have a story that unfolds where you thought you're totally secure and you realize you're standing on a shark, you're standing on something that's totally not secure, that was the lesson of the time of Purim. And that's why Adol Yada ben Aruch Haman Baruch Mordechai, at the outset of the story, Haman and Mordechai was all one. Chazal said, Kirtzon Ish V'Ish. Achashverosh wanted to please Ish Yehudi Haya V'Shushan Abira, refers to Mordechai, Ish Tzar V'Oyev Haman. The word Ish is an allusion to both Haman and Mordechai. At the beginning, it's Kirtzon Ish V'Ish. We're all together. No problem. One big happy family. At the end, the Jews were more acutely aware of the threats that were lurking, and therefore they saw the Noraos, the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was there. So although the mitzvah is to be so happy that it's Adol Yada ben Aruch Haman Baruch Mordechai, it's exactly because the limud of Purim, the lesson of Purim, is to recognize the vast difference between Aruch Haman Baruch Mordechai. Haman is here and Mordechai is here, and never the twain shall meet. They're on opposite sides, and it's only through the chesed of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we were saved then and that we continue to exist, Baruch Hashem. Okay, I wish everyone a happy Freilichen Purim.